along. And happy Easter, by the way, to everybody who is celebrating Easter this weekend. It is a wonderful weekend. Nice weather outside. Who could complain, huh? Well, some people will complain. And they'll complain because they're in a bit of hot water. It's interesting. I was watching a story in the United Kingdom where a teacher, similar to the Enoch Burke story in Ireland only recently, where Enoch, of course, found himself in court after he'd been suspended for misgendering a student or for refusing to misgender or gender a student or say or use the student's identity. Now, as you know, the Enoch Burke case is a little bit more complicated in the fact that he's in jail at the moment. A lot of people believe he's in jail for misgendering. He's not in jail for misgendering. He's in jail for not obeying the order of the court. And you've got to give him 10 out of 10 for perseverance. But a slightly different story to that is, in the United Kingdom, we have a similar situation where a teacher, Kevin Lister, refused to use the gender identity of a student, who for the purpose of the conversation is known as Pupil A. And Pupil A wanted to be referred to as a male, although Pupil A was born female. And the teacher refused to do so. He joins me on the line. Kevin Lister, good afternoon to you. Kevin, where did this... Let's go back to the very start of all this. I mean, when I say the student is not a very young student. Student is 17 years of age, Pupil A. So when were you first aware that Pupil A had changed their identity or wanted to be known as a different identity?
So Student A sent me a message on Teams on the 3rd of September 2021. So immediately coming back to college after the summer break. So it was a short sort of two-line message saying, I would like to be known as her new name. Can you change the one note to reflect that? So I did. And that was basically all I had from. And she said that everybody else in the class knows, so it'd be useful if you did the same as well. And I thought to myself, whoa, you know, that's, straight off.
Were you taken back by that? I mean, because you would be familiar with the students.
Yes,
I mean, you had no idea up to that point.
No idea that this was coming. Absolutely just, just shocked by it.
Yeah.
So the immediate thing I did was to raise a safeguarding concern. There was a big, heavy pro-trans ideology and philosophy in the college. And it was an issue much talked about in the staff room. About how we should affirm students and use wrong pronouns and so forth. So, but it hadn't happened to me yet at that point. I'd only been in the college for a year at that point. So I was kind of sort of still learning the ropes of what the culture was. So the immediate thing I did was to raise a safeguarding concern. And I asked three questions. I said, do we have parental consent? Is she making an informed decision? And is there a risk that she'll self-medicate with testosterone? And I also referred to the Keira Bell case. I said, in light of the Keira Bell case, we need to consider this carefully and also consider it in terms of her current academic progress and concerns about her academic progress. So it goes to safeguarding. And then I went down to safeguarding to check that they had the concern and it wasn't going to fall through a crack. And then... And then went down on the 7th of February, a couple of days after, 4 days afterwards, to ask what the outcome was and what safeguarding's plan was. So I expected to hear something like, we're going to do a proper safeguarding investigation, we'll have a safeguarding strategy meeting and so on and so forth. But what they said is the college strategy is not to tell the parents.
Wow.
You've got to be kidding me.
Okay, so the student is still a minor. To clarify, the student is still classed legally as a minor.
So everyone says that she's 17, that therefore she can have medical consent. Well, no, she's 17. That means she is a child, and this is not a medical treatment. This is effectively like a large scale tattoo. This is a cosmetic surgery kind of thing. You don't put children in for cosmetic surgery in the same way you shouldn't put them in for this. So.
Just to interrupt you, I assume that if a student comes to you with a problem, I'm not familiar, obviously, I'm not a teacher, but I'm assuming when a student comes to you with a problem, be it, say, mental health problem or depression or share something, they may be suicidal or whatever, you have a duty and a responsibility, A, not only to report that to the school, but also a duty and a responsibility to make sure the parents are aware if indeed they are a minor. I'm assuming that would be normal procedure.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and that's effectively what's applying here. You know, student does something completely out of the blue. I raise a safeguarding concern. Do we have parental consent? And the college position is, no, we're not going to tell the parents. Oh, yeah. So have a stand-up row with the safeguarding. I said, you can't possibly do this. We've got to treat this as a proper safeguarding concern. We've got to inform the parents. And I said to safeguarding, do you know the answer to question 2 and 3? Is she making an informed decision? And is there a risk she'll take cross-sex hormones by self-medication? She said, no, we don't know that. I explained to her the risk, the danger of taking testosterone, because I got myself fairly well up to speed on that. There was also a Swedish study in 2010. It was the best study at the time on transgender outcomes. And it shows that the rate of suicide of female to male transitioners is 40 times greater than the control groups, 40 times greater. Mm-hmm. And I was explaining to her that there is a massive increase in suicide risk.
When you were talking to the student and explaining this to the student, was that a conversation, a reasonable conversation? Did it get heated at any stage?
At this time, I hadn't spoken to the student at all.
Okay.
So the message comes, I immediately raise a safeguarding concern. So safeguarding say, their policy is not to tell the parents. In the meantime, they've had a conversation with the student. And they basically, the safeguarding response was, are you okay? Are you okay with the drugs? And the student says, I don't have any problem with the drugs. Well, I don't know what that means. Does that mean she's got tons of them? Does that mean she's getting them from her friends in the college? No idea whatsoever.
Or online.
The safeguarding response was to tell the student how to change a name on the college system and to tell the student how to go about changing her gender on the college system. So basically, the safeguarding response was to encourage the social transitioning of the student, the very thing I'm concerned about in the safeguarding referral.
So at what point were the parents consulted, or were they consulted at any stage?
Well, 21st of February, when I was suspended,
I don't want to skip over that. What led to your suspension? Now, there was a story, of course, that you had put up on the whiteboard on the wall in relation to a maths exam, that you had put her in the girls' section rather than the boys' section, you had dead named her. Was that true, or did that?
So we had a girls' maths competition. So after I'd made the safeguarding concern, I hadn't spoken to the student. I'd had no direction from safeguarding other than to say that they're not going to tell the parent. They hadn't actually told me that I had to refer to her with a new name and a new gender and so forth. So there was a mass Olympiad specifically set up for girls, encouraged to girls to take mass STEM type careers. So I'm encouraging all the girls in the class to enter the competition. And there's four girls in the class, and they're all being a bit reticent. So I said, okay, write the names up on the board to encourage them. If one name's up, another one will put a name forward. And bit by bit, the names of the students come forward, and I write them on the board as a way of encouraging everybody to engage. And it's my job as a maths teacher to encourage students to do maths. Anyway, student A at the back of the class, once most of the names are up, says, can I still do this? And I thought, I mean, it was a provocative question, trying to make a point to everybody else in the class. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, of course you can, because you're a girl. So I wrote her girl's name up, because it's a girl's maths competition that she's asking if she can still go into. But that apparently was being harassing and discriminating.
Okay. And this is the reason why. Was that the final kind of straw, as far as the school was concerned, that led to your suspension?
No. So she waited behind after the class, worried about doing the test. And in the conversation, she was more worried about getting a bad mark than she was about a name being going up on the board. So I said to her, make sure you have a go at this. This will look good on your UCAS application.
Yeah.
I'll work with you over the lunchtime so we can practice. So I did it, laid everything out for her. And then she got really emotional and started crying. I said, is this the transitioning thing that's upsetting you? And she said, yeah. I said, you need to be really careful about this. You need to make sure that you understand the risk. It's extremely dangerous. And you make sure that you're not getting pushed into it by anybody else.
Because you were concerned this was a social contagion, obviously. Yeah,
completely. Yeah. And that she didn't know what she was doing, and she was getting bamboozled into it by others. So I had that conversation with her, and I said, look, it's up to you at the end of the day, but make sure you know what you're doing.
It's a reasonable conversation to have, I suppose, in the position you're in.
So I said to her that if things are bad, then the thing that tends to happen to people who are experiencing bad things is that they will tend to comply with the person who is oppressing them. The greater the oppression, the more the oppressed will try and comply with the oppressor. So I try to give us some examples of that. And anyway, she, you know, after it was only a 5-minute conversation, not even a conversation I particularly prepared for. So she goes away and said, "Okay, I'll think about it. I'll think about doing the test, and I'll think about this transition."
And she seemed okay when she walked away from that conversation.
Yeah, she was obviously upset. But yeah, likewise, I was upset. This is one of my students I'd worked really hard for and really really hard with, and she was starting to make good progress. She'd had a tough first year. She was on the up, and then suddenly, you know, this thing comes out the blue. So anyway, so she goes away, as I say, thinking, she's going to reflect and maybe try and do the test, and then reflect on her decision to pursue this ideal that she might want to become a boy. She subsequently enters the girls' maths competition as a girl. She does, it's a voluntary thing. She goes all the way up to the top of the maths floor, you know, and enters. So my immediate interpretation of that was that she was having second thoughts about being a boy.
And at any stage, did she raise any other issue about the fact that maybe you were referring to her as she, or using her female name, or there was no other suggestion? Okay, so you had thought that maybe she had reflected on her decision and that maybe there was a change. Yeah.
Correct, yeah. And also, the other criticism of me in the tribunal was that because the safeguarding response was not the response that I wanted, I should have raised it to management. But the last thing I wanted to do was raise it to management, because when I had the first safeguard, you know, when I had the first meeting with the safeguarding, I asked, can I raise it any higher? And I was told that there was no point. It had already been raised higher and the decision would not be changed. And by this time, you know, the stable, you know, she'd already bolted. So my concern was if I raise it further with management, they'll just encourage it further along this pathway. It seemed to me that the situation was going to blow out, and it was just now, you know, a case of waiting for time. So I carry on teaching as per usual. And then the next thing is in January, 23rd of January, I think it was, her friend stays behind after class. And a friend demands that I should refer to her as a he, and with her new name. And I try to say to her friend that this is really not very good. You know, it's dangerous. You know, as a friend, what you should be trying to do is encourage her to be reflective. I said, it's a dangerous thing to do now, because I said to her, the world is going into a bad place. This was just before the start of the Ukraine war. And the world is heading into a bad place, and the last thing you want to do is make yourself more dependent on healthcare. And so I tried to, in a short conversation I hadn't prepared for, I tried to lay the ground out and reason with her. And she said, "Well, if you don't do it, I'm going to put a complaint in." I said, "Okay, well, put a complaint in."
And did you think she was good? Did you think she was going to put a complaint in? And the other question I was asking, in hindsight now, on reflection, do you think probably it should have been a case of maybe you shouldn't have bothered trying to help, because it look how it's reflected on your career now at this stage.
You're absolutely right. I think, you know, in hindsight, I would do the same thing. I would raise a safeguarding concern. My job as a teacher is to teach maths. My other job as a teacher is to make sure safety is paramount in my classes. You know, the college should have a safeguarding procedure and policy, which it's got and which I complied with. The college should have done a proper safeguarding investigation. But the criticism that from the tribunal to me is that because I wasn't happy with the safeguarding concern, I should have then raised it with management. Because I didn't do so, that's basically why the case has collapsed around me. So
I suppose the hearing focused very much on the fact that, and it says in the hearing heard how Lister had wrote the student A's birth name, known as her dead name, on a classroom white room board during discussion about whether the student should be entering a nationwide girls maths competition. That they kind of focused very much on that in the hearing, didn't they? In other words, what they tried to suggest, or what they're suggesting, was you humiliated the student. But from what you're telling me, you believe you didn't humiliate her, because you spoke to her afterwards. You had a reasonable conversation with her. She went away. She came back. She entered the maths competition as a girl. So that didn't seem to be an issue from your point of view.
Yeah, exactly. And then, the follow on from that was that I then harassed and discriminated by pointing at her rather than using her name. Well, I'm not allowed to use her birth name because I'm going to be dead naming, and I don't want to use her new name because I've got no parental consent, and it's a part of a social transitioning. The college's position.
If you had, sorry for interrupting, but if you had parental consent, for example, if her parents had a visit to the school and said, listen, we're aware of this, we've spoken to her about this, she does prefer, if you want to, if you could use the new he pronoun and, you know, and a male name, would you have done that?
Well, I think that, you know, the parental view is important in a safeguarding issue, no question about it. But the parental view isn't the only input that goes into understanding a safeguarding situation. The parents can be wrong, and the parental view should have been part of a wider safeguarding strategy meeting where, you know, maybe the parents sit down with social services and the college and maybe medical professionals, and everyone sits down. And if there is a genuine reason why a student needs to be referred to in the wrong sex, then yeah, then let's hear it and let's put it out. But I don't know if a parent comes along and says that, you know, that I want my daughter to be referred to as a he. I don't know what's behind that parent's decision. Has a parent just woken up in the morning and fancy changing their daughter from a female to a male? You know, is it a parent-driven situation? And certainly in the Tavistock case with Sonia Appleby, then she was making quite clear that a big driver for transitioning of students was parents, was it the kind of Munchausen by proxy type parent situation.
And in relation to the hearing itself, obviously it was a costly matter. I mean, you said you represented yourself because I had to, not because I wanted to, but the NEW withdrew their support. My insurance company would not pay, and I didn't want to draw down on anyone else. So in other words, you ended up going into huge financial difficulties yourself because of this.
Yeah.
And did you think, in the world we live in today, it's bizarre to ask this question, but did you think you were going to win the case? Because it looked like you were at a loss from the word go, really, doesn't it?
I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a barrister. Yeah, it's a highly complex case. People represent themselves in the employment tribunal normally for things like, you know, you're being fired because you for whatever reason, a simple single thing. But this was much more complicated. I thought I might have a good chance because I thought the facts were so, you know, incontrovertible that, you know, there was only one person who made a complaint. That was student B. Student A's voice had never been heard. I'd referred the issue to Swindon Borough Council when I got suspended. I said there's two safeguarding concerns that I'd raised, which haven't been reviewed by the college. So there's this safeguarding concern about student A. There's another concern that I raised about a teacher who was encouraging students let me be precise about the words. This other teacher, in her words, was directly supporting four transgender students. Well, however that support was, I don't know. So I raised a safeguarding concern about her. Neither of them got addressed. So I reported it to the local MASH, the multi-agency safeguarding hub. They then basically phone the college and say, here's two safeguarding concerns, make sure you investigate, which the college never did. And the Swindon hub had recognized the failures of the college's process. They said, their safeguarding executive said, that student A's voice hadn't been heard. So I thought I had a good chance, in as much that the failure of the college to manage its safeguarding put them in an extremely weak position. But that's not the way it works anymore. I mean, what we have is a completely different situation now. What we, you know, what I've learned from this awful experience is that we now put the Equality Act above safeguarding in our schools. So a student can now basically come along and say, you know, I think I'm transgender because the school's been indoctrinating them. They become that person. They instantly have protected characteristic status. As soon as anybody speaks to that student and says, you know, be careful what you're doing here, that's it. You are speaking to the student in a way that's harassing and discriminating and not welcomed by them.
Rather than somebody who just cares. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that, where does that leave you now? I mean, I don't know if you can take an appeal against that now, or are you planning taking an appeal against it?
I've got lawyers and barristers are looking at the paperwork to start pushing an appeal forward. The problem is, if you go for an appeal, if it goes wrong, then then the costs then, you know, are enormous. It's
spiraling at this stage, I imagine.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I then have to pick up all the costs of the other side.
Now, I know you do have a GoFundMe, and what we will do at the end of the podcast when we do put it out, actually, we'll put a link up to the GoFundMe as well. But so you do have a GoFundMe to try and help you this, because of course you're not going to get free legal aid. You're certainly not going to get anybody to help you with the costs. And to top of all that, you lost your job, so you can't even get employed as a school teacher.
It's more than just losing my job. Okay, yeah, I've been referred to the DBS. In the UK, we've got the Disclosure and Barring Service. So the college then justified the suspension of me on safeguarding grounds that I'd caused emotional harm to a transitioning student. So I've now been referred to the DBS. The DBS is a completely woke left-wing, or I assume it's run by crazy woke left-wingers. On the 19th of December, they put me on the barred list. So I'm basically on the same level as Ian Huntley and all the other paedophiles and murders. So I can never teach again.
So as far as they're concerned, you're a danger to children. That's the kind of category you're in now.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Does that put you in a bad position now, not just as a teacher, but any job that would require, vetting?
Yeah. Exactly. So I can't work for Tesco's as a van driver because you need DBS clearance for that. I can't help out at my local athletics club with the kids in the competitions every year. You know, the local athletics club has said, you know, sorry, Kev, you know, we don't actually think you're going to be a harm, but you are DBS barred, so don't come anywhere near here.
Oh, because you misgendered a student.
Misgendered a student. Well, really, all because I raised, you know, two safeguarding concerns.
Mm. I mean, when we look at this story, I mean, we've seen very similar stories around the world. This is not the first time this happened in the UK, and it also happened in the Isle of Man, and it's happened all across America. And as I said, it's happened here, a slightly different story, but it has happened here as well. Do you think going forward, and Rishi Sunak only spoke about this going back about 5 or 6 months ago, by the way, when he talked, he referred to this as being nonsense, this kind of ridiculous idea that, for example, the NHS were using words like pregnant people and all this kind of stuff. And he said, we need to go back to, you know, to grassroots when it comes to this kind of stuff. And he kind of poo-pooed this nonsense. But yeah, it seems to be getting worse. So if the Prime Minister of the country is saying, let's stop this nonsense, but yet you're in the situation you're in, where does that fare off?
Yeah, it is absolutely crazy. The other thing that I would say as well is we need to step back from this, you know, from the nitty gritty of my issue here, and online on Twitter, everyone, all the trolls are all slagging me off and so on and so forth. I mean, I really couldn't give a damn even reading the comments. But this is the important thing, you know. Let's focus on the nub of this and what's happening. This is a massive social experiment, a massive social and medical experiment, the likes of which we have never seen before. You know, this experiment that we come along with, you know, we convince young children that they can be of the opposite sex. A girl can be a boy can be a girl. In the Keira Bell case, the judgment was clear that this is an experiment. There is no medical evidence at all to back it up or support it. Okay, now, where else have we had big experiments, big medical experiments? The last big medical experiment was in Auschwitz of a similar ethical proportion. And the first attempts to transition children from one sex to another were attempted in Auschwitz. This is what we're talking about. This is the moral depravity that we are talking about. And the technology today might be better than the technology that Dr. Josef Mengele had in Auschwitz, but the moral standard, the moral position is about the same. In 1947, after Auschwitz, after the Second World War, the international community came together to write the Nuremberg Codes. There was a 10-point Nuremberg Code for medical ethics that discussed things like consent of a person, discussed things like injury, discussed things like the benefit to mankind for the experiment being undertaken and so forth. If you compare the trans medical experiment is ongoing now against those 10 points in the Nuremberg Code, it fails every single one of them.
But what we're seeing now is, because of course of the advent of social media has certainly been a huge player in this, because it's almost promoted like some sort of cool thing for kids to do. And I think that's particularly sad. Now, there is no doubt that our students out there and I think we all have to be conscious of this, Kevin, who have confusion and who get confused about their gender. And, you know, and we've always had that, by the way, since I was in school. You know, they're always got these kids, you know, some boys would be a bit effeminate and some girls maybe masculine. In our day, we call them tomboys. But that's all changed. And I only spoke recently to one doctor who said when she was 16 years of age, she was referred to as a tomboy because she wanted to play rugby. She wanted to do what the boys were doing. She used to hang around with her brother's mates. But now she's turned out to be a married woman with four children and has embraced her own femininity. But she said, if when I was 16, if it had been now, somebody would have encouraged me to change my gender, which could have been drastic. But that's what's happening now. And we do have to be very conscious that when we have a child, you know, who is confused about their gender, that they should get support. They absolutely should get support. We should support them in every way they possibly can. But I think what we're doing essentially is socially is we're encouraging children almost to do this.
We're not, yeah, you're absolutely right. We're doing more than encouraging, we're indoctrinating them. So from about the age of five, when kids hit school, you know, they're getting LGBTQ taught to them and indoctrinated into them, you know, from day one until the point when they get to the age of 17, 18, then they start moving down this pathway and everyone says, oh, that's great. You know, you can consent now because you're old enough. No, you're not consenting because you're old enough. You've been indoctrinated. You are not making an informed decision. So in New College where I was at, you know, someone sent me the PowerPoint materials that were being used in the RSC educations, and it was all pro-trans. There was no discussion at all about the side effects of taking testosterone, its irreversibility, you know, the need for caution. The gender reassignment policy that was at the hub of my case is completely pro-trans. It even has links at the back for staff or students to use, which takes you all to transgender lobby groups and tells you about, you know, the benefits of taking testosterone and having for women having a double mastectomy and so forth. You know, there was not one bit of evidence anywhere about the damage that this can do and the irreversibility of it and so forth. And what you're saying is absolutely right. When I was 17, 18, I was an idiot. I mean, you know, anybody that's following this, who remembers me from my days, will know I was an idiot. We make mistakes when we're younger. But what we didn't do was have mistakes that would be irreversible, and we weren't encouraged to pursue irreversible mistakes.
Well, mind you, that has changed somewhat. The NHS have now banned the prescribing puberty blockers, and I know they're talking about trying to get it done in this country too, although there are too many woke politicians in this country as well. But at the hearing, by the way, in Bristol, in the Civil Justice Centre, the college's principal and chief executive at the time, Carol Kitchen, said it was the way Lister's gender critical beliefs were manifested that led to his dismissal and not the views himself. So in other words, that what they were trying to say was they took on board the fact that you had a history of maybe being critical in relation to, you know, gender reassignment or that kind of thing. What do you say to that accusation?
No, I mean, it's just absolute rubbish what they were saying. And I tried to get that across in the tribunal. It didn't seem to go across. So basically what happened was I had that one conversation with student B. So she writes a list of everything. So I'm trying to explain to her why she should temper caution when she has the conversations with her friend. That then gets used by Charlotte Best as evidence that I've been transphobic. There's then a second report done by Jane Davidson, who is the college assistant principal. So she takes each one of the bullet points and says, another student has said this, another student has said that, another student says this, to make it look as if what I had said had been said in front of the classroom. When I, in the cross-examination that I had with Lynn Plested, the now deputy principal, I said that you have a vision that I stood in front of the classroom, wasting valuable maths teaching time, pontificating about transgenderism in front of student A. And she kind of muttered and said, yes. And, well, where's the evidence?
And did you at any stage, Kevin, in front of the whole classroom, you talk about gender critical theory or anything like that?
Not once, ever. And I never would, ever. And when I spoke to student B, I didn't tell student B that I'd raised a safeguarding concern about student A because I wanted to protect her confidentiality. I didn't raise it with my manager to protect student A's confidentiality. And I never raised it in the classroom. The only thing I didn't do was go along with the social transition because it seemed to me her request was ambiguous, especially after she entered the girls' maths competition. I never raised it in the classroom. at all, ever, and certainly did not debate it in front of the classroom in the way that was alleged.
Coming back to an earlier question that I asked you, that you know, at any stage, would you be happy enough to, you know, use somebody's gender identity pronoun? You know, what are your thoughts, generally speaking? You know, for example, if you were out or you met somebody or a friend or you're out for dinner and somebody asked you to refer to them as a pronoun that you knew that they weren't biologically assigned, would you use the pronoun?
Probably not, no, because it depends. I mean, that's a very much as a depends situation. But you know, my gut reaction.
I know we don't get to use pronouns. I mean, I only said this to somebody the other day. Generally, we don't use pronouns unless it's in the third party anyway.
Well,
you know.
Well, I can't think of any circumstance where I would be, you know, out socially and meet friends where I would tell anybody how to speak and how to think. And I would pretty much have the same response back if somebody asked me to do the same. They say, yeah, thank you. I understand, you know, that you know, you want to compel me how to speak, but really, you know, what I'm seeing in front of me is a guy, not a girl, or a girl, not a guy. And you know, with respect, I would rather speak to you in the way that I feel most appropriate. I don't think anybody should be allowing anybody, you know, I don't think anybody should be allowed to compel somebody how to speak and what to say. You know, therein lies the pathway to totalitarianism. You know, one of the things that I have to show in court was that I didn't believe that what they were doing was a legitimate mean to or a proportionate mean to a legitimate aim. And one of the things that they said that the legitimate aim was to allow people to express their identity in the class. Well, I've had people with all sorts of identities in my class. I've had goths, I've had punks, I've had Muslims, I've had Hindus, I've had, you know, and the class gets enriched for people with different ideas and things. Mm-hmm. But never have I had somebody with a personal identity which they inflict upon everybody else and expect everybody else to validate. So
I've explained this to people in the past. For example, if you had a Muslim in your class, there's no way you would accept if that Muslim demanded everybody believed in Allah, for example. They can believe in Allah and you respect that they believe in Allah, but they don't demand that everybody else do it at the same time. Going forward for you now, I mean, the situation you're in is a desperate situation. You can't be a teacher. You can't get any job that needs vetting whatsoever because you're now considered to be a danger to children just because you wouldn't accept the gender identity of a child. Or a minor, where does that leave you now, Kevin?
So we're going to look at an appeal. I don't know if I can stomach an appeal at the moment. I need to make sure, you know, I've got the finances in place. There's a huge number of people come to me with support and quite substantial sums of money, but I'm not going to pursue it unless there's really, really good grounds to do so. I want to challenge in court the DBS ruling. We've got the paperwork into the upper tribunal to appeal the DBS ruling. What I'm also doing as well is I'm involved with the Bad Law Project now, and I'm the lead witness for a judicial review that the Bad Law Project has started against the Department for Education. So in the UK, we've got the Education Act, Section 406 and 407 are the two important sections of that. Section 406 bans the teaching of politically partisan topics, and Section 407 mandates that the teaching is balanced. So what we argue is that the introduction of the gender ideology into schools is in violation of both 406 and 407 of the Education Act. And that it was done deliberately. This didn't happen by mistake. You know, this was a deliberate thing that happened in conjunction with the Department for Education to bring this ideology into schools. And there's an extremely strong audit trail.
I find it quite bizarre, actually, that particularly here in Ireland and England, not so much, because of course there's always been a great mix of different religions and ethoses. But in Ireland, as you know, we would have a Catholic ethos in this country primarily, and yet we've spent the last 10 or 15 or 20 years trying to remove the indoctrination of Catholic ethos from schools, because 85% of our schools are Catholic schools, and we're trying to remove that ethos, and slowly but surely we're doing it. And by the way, I have no objection to people's religions. You know, if you want to do it after school or at home, absolutely. absolutely, and they should embrace their religion if that's what they want to do. But we're trying to remove that ethos or that indoctrination, and yet we're now replacing it with another indoctrination. And we're having the same difficulty here because they're now changing the curriculum in Ireland. They've already changed it for a junior cycle or A levels, as it would be, or B level, whatever it is in the UK. I'm not too sure what they call the junior cert in the United Kingdom, but the 15, 16 year olds. And now they want to introduce it next year into primary level education, where they bring in gender ideology, or as you call it, gender ideology, or gender teaching in the curriculum for primary school children.
Yeah, it's absolutely unbelievable. And Ireland's history of the oppression that it suffered with the Catholic Church is a terrible thing. It makes terrible, terrible, painful reading. And I've read much on it. But what we're doing in the UK and in Ireland is, we're allowing this ideology into schools, which is far worse than Catholicism. With Catholicism, we weren't pushing kids to take in cross-sex hormones. These drugs are easily available online. I mean, you can buy them anywhere for tuppence halfpenny. A young female can easily take all the testosterone she needs in a year for not much more than a pocket money. This is easy.
And these drugs can be irreversible, can cause problems with bone density, can cause sterility. They can cause a lot of problems, and it's something that you really need to think about before you do it. And I would absolutely say the same thing, Kevin. Kevin, it's been a very interesting conversation. I'd like to keep up with you and let's see how you get on. I do wish you well, and I know many people do. You've got a mixed reaction on social media, primarily people supporting you, actually, I have to say, from what I've seen. But there has been a mixed reaction. How are you handling the negative reaction?
It's just what it is. I mean, I never block anybody. People say block people. If people want to slag me off, that's fine. It's a free country. And if they want to claim that I'm a child abuser or a bully or a harasser, then yeah, stick your name up. I don't really care. It's water off a duck's back to me.
Have you been harassed personally yourself? I mean,
I get the usual death threats and things coming through. I've not had anyone pitching up at the door trying to beat me up at anything yet.
And how are you? By the way, I didn't ask, but how are you? I mean, how are you as a person holding up through all this? Because it's very difficult to hold up through negativity like this.
No, thanks. That's a really good question. It's been, I can't tell you how emotionally tough this has been on me. It's tough on me. Personally, losing my career. I mean, I really love teaching. I would go back and I'd teach for nothing tomorrow. Get me in a classroom teaching maths, and that's all I want to do. I don't really want to do much else in life. Loss of that is bad. But to be quite frank, the thing that has just torn me to pieces is what has happened to my student, to student A. I cannot believe that she went into this voluntarily. It seems to me that she got pushed and cajoled into this by everybody around her. And, other than me, I don't see that there was any evidence of anybody listening to her voice and saying, just be careful about what you're doing here.
Well, you spoke to her. So you would have a better idea than probably most, because you did speak to her, honestly, in relation to it. Look, as I said, I wish you well, and I hope you get through this, because it is a very difficult time, particularly when people are piling on like that. And I know you've been on media, you've been on different TV stations and radio stations talking about your case. I'm sure you're sick talking about it at this stage, and maybe you just want a bit of time out from it all at this stage.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm going out for a bike ride and reading, catching up on some books. I started a mass problem about 3 years ago. It was a climate change-related mass problem, which I worked on for about 2 years, and I put it all to one side, so I'm dusting that back off.
Yeah.
So keep your mind busy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might be time for me to move my brain onto other things. But I wrote a book many, many years ago, and one of the things it made me so sensitive about this. The book was on climate change. It's called The Vortex of Violence and Why We're Losing the War on Climate Change. And I was looking at what was the chance of making a successful agreement on climate change. And works out at 6 × 10⁻³, and work it out through a game theory analysis. So virtually nothing. That's less than the chance of finding a single atom from all the atoms that make the planet. And one of the things that occurred to me was that as climate change gets worse, competition will increase. And we'll have to convince, more and more, we'll have to do the things that we know that we shouldn't do. We'll have to burn more fossil fuels, fight harder. When we know that that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. And what I said then, what I speculated on then, was that we would enter into a phase of collective schizophrenia. And I can't help but think that this is part of that collectors.
I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and I'm an atheist. Right? I don't believe in God, but I do respect people's religion. And do you think that the fall off in the belief of a religion, you know, particularly for young people, those people primarily, I suppose, between the age of 16 and 30 years of age, that the fact that they don't have something to follow, i.e. they're not following a religion or a god or whatever it is, do you think it's because of that they want to follow something else? So the next thing will be climate change, or the next thing will be veganism, or the next thing will be gender identity, or the next thing will be... So in other words, they always have to have something to be part of something. Am I wrong in thinking that?
Yeah, I think it's a really, really, really good analogy that you've made. I'm like you. I'm a born again and committed atheist. But I think having the moral framework of religion is very, very beneficial to people. But again, you know, to talking about trying to belong to something, young people that I was teaching were really bright, really switched on. I mean, it was a real pleasure to be in the classroom with them, and they would have quite often, you know, really good discussions at the end of the class or even within classes about topics of concern. One of which was regularly was climate change, because they knew I was heavily involved in climate change issues. And they were on the ball. They knew that this was going to make their life crap when they grew up, and they were terrified by it. In 2010, when it was sort of mandated in the UK schools that an inconvenient truth was to be shown to everybody, there was a palpable sense of change in student atmosphere and students' behavior after that, that they realized that the future was going to be tough and hard. And there was that despondency. And then sort of climate activism came along, and the schools had to include sustainability on the curriculum. And then it reached a pinnacle with Greta Thunberg and the school strikes. And then
I wouldn't be a fan of Greta. To be honest,
yeah, that's fine. Okay, but you know, she was a young person speaking up for young people. It's easy for us, as more elderly gentlemen to pontificate and to critique. But the point I'm making is that young people were doing the best that they could at that time to raise their voice on climate change, and they can see the ship around them is starting to break up and sink, and they're looking to the future in panic. And then suddenly nothing happens at all. And what they left with? Well, then along comes a transgender idea. So climate change is black and bleak and dark when you look at that. And you know, I know, because I spent a lot of time looking in detail at the mathematics behind climate change. And it is hugely stressful, hugely dark. And it presents a future of constraints and restriction to everybody. Then along comes transgender with its rainbows and its idea that you can be anything you want to be, and all you can be, you can be yourself. It's such a wonderful contrast to that dark message that has been infused into students for a long period of time. So the combination of that made it easy for the trans ideology to get traction in schools. And then along comes the huge explosion of social media. So it's like a perfect storm, all sorts of things happening at once together.
And I think it's so unfair on young people. I mean, we've been very unfair on young people. Look, when we were kids, we didn't have much to deal with, apart from which was your favourite band, Pink Floyd, Queen, or whoever it happened, AC/DC. But nowadays, students have so much to contend with because we're kind of bombarding them with all this stuff, and they kind of have to pick something to be part of something, you know, because everybody else is part of something. And that's why I mentioned at the very start of this, particularly in the United Kingdom, we're seeing, you know, certain schools will have a lot of children who will be changing their identities, whereas other schools have none at all. And it is, you know, a contagion within the school. But look, it is what it is, and you are where you are, and it's a very difficult situation you find yourself in, Kevin, and I do wish you well, and on a personal level I wish you well too, and I hope you're dealing with it well, and we look forward to hearing you from the future, hopefully successful in your appeal, by the way. And if people want to support you or want to follow you, they can find you online, Kevin Lister, and we will put a link up as well on our profile too. I know you have a GoFundMe there at the moment to try and help you with the cost of this, because nobody else is helping you with the cost. Kevin, thank you very much indeed for joining us, and I appreciate it, and I wish you well.
Thank you for having me on.